From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and the story I'm about to tell should be disturbing to all listeners. William Donegan was a longtime resident of Springfield, Illinois. He was an entrepreneur in the 1800s, a cobbler said to have been friendly with Abraham Lincoln. He brought many black people to Springfield for work before and after the Civil War, sometimes in conditions that were less than favorable, but he also wrote about having hidden scores of enslaved people in his house, helping them on their way to freedom in Canada. And he had a family, married for more than 30 years to Sarah Rudolph. He was 80 years old on the night of August 15th, 1908, when a mob stormed his house, dragged him outside, beat him, cut his throat, and hanged him from a low tree across the street. The militia arrived and the crowd scattered, and Donegan died the next morning at St. John's Hospital. 2 days later, his niece, Carrie Hamilton, was quoted in the Chicago Tribune. "They say my uncle was killed because he is married to a white woman, but they have been married 20 years, have children, and own considerable property. And the property was the cause of his murder. He was even told by some of the ringleaders of the mob that he had too much property." Lynching is often thought of as a crime happening down there. As Billie Holiday sang, "Southern trees bear a strange fruit," but so did our trees in Illinois, at least 56 times, according to the Equal Justice Initiative. The murder of William Donegan in Springfield, as well as that of Scott Burton, who was lynched while trying to save his barbershop, were part of what's come to be known as the Springfield Race Riot of 1908. That event spurred the creation of the NAACP. It also added to the calls for federal anti-lynching legislation, as did so many other murders in the decades since. But it wasn't until March 7th of this year, 2022, that the Congress heeded that call. After nearly 200 failed attempts to outlaw lynching, Congress passed the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act. This is an effort that's been underway since at least 1900 and has been championed in recent iterations by U.S. Representative Bobby Rush of Illinois. It's named after Emmett Till, another black Illinoisan, a teenager from Chicago, who in 1955 was brutally murdered by a group of white men during a visit to Mississippi. At his funeral, Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, insisted on an open casket, forcing the world to confront what had been done to her son, and in so doing, helping propel the civil rights movement. Now the legislation is headed to President Joe Biden's desk. Here to talk about the significance of this legislation, as well as consider the historical and present effects of lynching and racial violence in Illinois, is Dr. Sundiata Chajwa. Professor Chajwa teaches in the Departments of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's a scholar, activist, and author of America's First Black Town, about Brooklyn, Illinois. Professor Chajwa, welcome to The 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Bill Freivogel, who is the director of the Southern Illinois University School of Journalism, a trained lawyer and publisher of the Gateway Journalism Review. He spent more than 30 years with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch covering the Supreme Court, civil rights policies, and civil liberties abuses. Now he contributes regularly to St. Louis Public Radio. Bill, welcome to you as well.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, as ever, you are welcome to join our conversation today. As we often say, is this history that you were taught about in Illinois? Are you aware of what has happened in our state in the past? We'd love to hear your perspective. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. So, Professor Chajwa, I want to begin with you. And can you begin with giving us a definition of lynching?
First, let me, the name, the last name is actually pronounced Chajwa.
Thank you. My apologies.
Lynching, there's various definitions. The one that was tied to the Dyer Bill made it a crime. So let me say it this way. A person had to be charged with a crime, had to be suspected of a crime, and the murder had to do with race or some other fixed category. And in that sense, then, when you think about the classic type of terror lynchings, the spectacles where you have 5,000, 10,000 people, and they come, a person has been accused of largely murdered. 40% of those people who were lynched or attempted lynchings were accused of murder, and the person that they were generally accused of murdering was their landlord, because we're talking about a phenomenon in which 95 to 97% of these lynchings are in the South. And we're talking about sharecropping and that whole plantation regime, PNH convict lease, and all of that helps explain this phenomenon. But it was generally held that a person had to be accused of a crime or suspected of a crime. Now, what we know is that once a lynching spree started, i.e. they began to hunt for someone, any Black person would do, right? So they lynched women, children, as well as men. Now, what we're dealing with today, the current Emmett Till bill speaks in terms of a hate crime, and not so much as in as historically it was limited to an accusation of an actual crime, right? In terms of the victim. Today we're not, when you look at Ahmaud Arbery, the state had not charged him with a crime. He was killed essentially for being Black and being in a neighborhood that white people did not believe, that at least three white men did not believe that he should be in. So the definition has varied over time. I do like the current bill. So let me stop there and let Bill get to jump in.
Yeah, Bill. I mean, I guess if you have a perspective on this, I think as the professor was saying, you have this sort of, we have this maybe historical image in our head of what this constitutes, but there are all kinds of murders that now, you know, fit under this rubric of what we're calling lynching under this legislation.
Right. I mean, the Arbery case is a good example of what really, constituted a lynching, but it didn't involve the kind of stereotype we have in our heads of the lynching of being hung from a tree. I mean, the East St. Louis 1917 riot, many of those people were hanged. Others were pushed off the river, across the Mississippi River and into the river, and killed that way. I mean, I think they all would constitute lynchings. The change that was made in the bill that finally passed Congress after, more than about 140 years of trying, was restrict it to death or severe bodily injury. That's what was needed to sort of bring on Rand Paul to finally support the bill and get it passed through the Senate.
And Professor, did you want to respond to that? Or I heard you
say yes. I would say, Bill, that I think the salient feature of lynching bills, and particularly the scholarly and more importantly, the conception of activists, speaking in terms of Ida B. Wells, Walter White, John Bruce Grit, those people who worked against lynching, the conception was that it was an accusation that the victim was guilty of some crime or breaking custom. You know, this notion that we refer to as Southern etiquette, which meant that Black people had to defer to white people in every situation, so that if you're walking on a sidewalk and you come across a white man or a woman, the expectation is that the Black person steps off the sidewalk into the road and allows the white person to pass. The expectation is that the Black people tilt their hat. The expectation is that Black people not look white people in the eye. Those types of things, as well as the overwhelming accusation of murder and the much more minor accusation of rape and attempted rape combined only constituted about 23% of all accusations. We're not even talking about whether or not the accusation is true. We're just talking about the accusation. So that for me, the most salient feature is that historically there had to be accusation of a crime or an accusation that the person had violated racial Southern etiquette. We're now, and I think that they're correct, to make the change to fit more with hate crimes, we're not likely to see the kind of spectacle lynchings that occurred in the late 19th century. You know, so you take, for example, in the 1890s, every 2.5 days, a Black man, woman, or child was lynched somewhere in the United States. You take a northern state like Illinois, it's tied with Kansas for the most Black people lynched. And even though at no point before 1940 did African-Americans constitute more than 4% of the state's population, they composed 56% of the lynchings. And so, and once we put it in that context, we understand that this is simply the use of force to maintain a system of racial oppression.
Well, let's talk about that history, because Bill, in June of 2020, after the New York Times and Nicole Hannah-Jones published their 1619 project on putting this, you know, race at the center of American history, the Gateway Journalism Review published its own 1857 project, which examined slavery and segregation and racism in St. Louis, Missouri, and Illinois. Can you talk about what went into that project? What inspired it?
Yes, this was a project where we brought together some of the civil rights leaders from St. Louis, some of the students whom I taught in the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University, and other contributors around Missouri and Illinois to try to tell the story of slavery and segregation in Missouri and Illinois during the period of the primarily centering on the 19th and 20th century, and then into our current century. We call it the 1857 Project because that's a notorious date in American history when the Dred Scott decision was handed down by the United States Supreme Court. And of course, that was a very, for those of us who live in St. Louis, it was a very important moment, and for the nation, it was a very important moment. It was, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court declaring that Black people had no rights that white people had any reason to respect, and that the Missouri Compromise of 1821 was actually unconstitutional because in preventing slavery in the new territories, it had taken away the property rights of people who owned slaves, and that violated their due process rights under the Bill of Rights. That's what the Dred Scott decision stood for. And then that spilled over really into the very next year, into the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. And we tried to reconstruct those seven debates where Abraham Lincoln debated against Stephen Douglas in what was then a U.S. Senate race that Douglas ended up winning. And you know, Douglas was saying that he was in favor of something called popular sovereignty. Any state should be able to decide on their own whether to have slavery. You know, so we oftentimes think of Lincoln as the abolitionist, but you know, to be honest, he wasn't an abolitionist at the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He wasn't really. I'm not sure he became an abolitionist until we got to the passage of the 13th Amendment a few months before he was assassinated as president. Lincoln, going across the state of Illinois, was very much on the defensive and saying, you know, he didn't think that that Negroes, as he referred to them, would ever be equal to whites or should ever even be able to vote or run for office. So it was certainly not a, he wasn't arguing for equality, but he was saying that the Dred Scott decision had been wrong that you should be able to, that the Congress should be able to prevent the spread of slavery through the territories. And then, of course, you know, into the 20th century, we have just a whole series of events with the 1917 riot in East St. Louis and St. Louis that killed at least 45 people, maybe as many as 100. Experts.
Well, let's talk more about that when we come back. We need to take a break. We're going to come back and continue this conversation. You can join us at 800-222-9455 if you want to talk about Illinois' history of racial violence. We're speaking with Bill Freivogel, who is the director of the SIU School of Journalism and publisher of the Gateway Journalism Review. Also, Professor Sundiata Chajua, who is in the Department of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about this because the Congress recently passed federal anti-lynching legislation after more than 120 years of efforts in that regard. We're going to continue this conversation. Again, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dr. Sundiata Chajua and Bill Freivogel. Dr. Chajua is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author of America's First Black Town, about Brooklyn, Illinois. Bill Freivogel is former director of the SIU School of Journalism, an attorney and publisher of the Gateway Journalism Review. He spent more than three decades with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch covering issues of civil rights, the Supreme Court, civil liberties abuses, and he's also a contributor to St. Louis Public Radio. You can join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, as one of our regular listeners did. She said, "My family went to visit EJI's, that's the Equal Justice Initiative's, Moving National Memorial for Peace and Justice and Legacy Museum in Montgomery. I feel strongly that Illinois counties need to retrieve their monuments and give them proper display and respect. Find them here." We'll have that on our website as well if you want to check out the Equal Justice Initiative's map of racial murders in Illinois and find out, you know, how your local area can reflect on its own role in that history. Professor Chajua, can you talk about that? There are 56 documented lynchings in Illinois between 1877 and 1950, according to the Equal Justice Initiative's report, Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror. This is, I believe, third highest among states outside the South. Can you give a little more insight into the history of racial violence in Illinois? Do you find that it's well understood among your students?
No, I think the students come in with some general notion that there was something about lynching, and it is, of course, tied to illegal hangings. It is Southern, and it is appropriate to have a Southern emphasis here, because again, as I said previously, somewhere between 95 and 97% of all lynchings did occur in the South. But Illinois, it's third in northern states in terms of total lynching. It's tied for first in terms of the lynching of Black people. You know, one of the things about Illinois that made it so violent in terms of race was struggles around labor, coal mining, working on the railroad, that you find very early on. You take Pena and Verdan, in 1898, you go up to Briarwood, 1874, you're gonna find that from the beginning, white workers in Illinois saw the influx of Black migrants from the South, those fleeing enslavement, right? Those who are self-emancipating themselves. And after the abolition of slavery, blacks pouring into the North and into the state of Illinois because it offered better work opportunities. While it did have a racist climate, it wasn't as racist as the southern states that bordered it, Kentucky, Missouri, et cetera. And so the reaction is hostile. You know, we can go down to the East St. Louis racial pogrom. We can go to Springfield. We can go to Chicago, 1919. And what we're going to find is that in addition to Illinois having an excessively high number of lynching and a particularly high level of black lynchings of black folk, we're going to find that there are two of the worst and a third racial pogrom that's very important. Now, Springfield is important, not just because of the people who lose their lives, but also it leads directly to the formation of an organization to contest lynching, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Their greatest success in their early years is in their leading a struggle, picking up from Ida B. Wells, the struggle against lynching. So that Illinois had a particularly anti-black climate that manifested itself very much in racial terrorism. And so you had this excessively high number of anti-black lynchings, and you have these racial pogroms. You know, one lynching that stands out in the state of Illinois is the 1909 lynching of Froggy Joe Evans in Joe James in Cairo. You've got 5,000 people who come out, and after he's lynched, you know, they cut off the head, and you know, if you leave a body part in water, it swells. And after the head is swollen, they put it on a pike with a big sign. So it was particularly virulent and heinous. And you know, and that characterized much of Illinois' history in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
I would just add on that point relating to the Cairo lynching in 1909 and the number of people there. I mean, this was a carnival kind of atmosphere.
Yes.
that these lynchings had. And in Cairo, they sold postcards in hotels in these early 1900s period of time that would be pictures of the lynching.
Yeah, yeah. That was quite common. Quite common, you know, and a lynching in my hometown, Decatur, and there is a group of people working to get a historic marker for Sam Bush, who was lynched there on June 3rd in 1893. But in the lynching of Samuel J. Bush, people stayed and waited for the lynchers to come in from Mount Zion. And they were there from like 6 p.m. until 2 a.m. And around midnight, it began to rain and people stayed. In fact, you get nearly 2,000 people in a torrential rain waiting for the lynchers to come in so that they can be part of it. You know, so they cheer, but they also want the rope. Oftentimes the body is riddled and body parts are cut up, you know, as well as burned, and people, you know, collect parts of the body and keep them. Tooths, it was a very big thing to collect the tooth of a lynched black person, drill a hole in it, put a gold chain on it, and give it to a woman that you expected to, you know, to have a long-term relationship or marry. So we're talking something that did not occur anywhere else in the world. Anywhere else in the world. Even in South Africa, you did not have a phenomena that's equivalent to lynching, where you had masses of private citizens engaged in this vigilante action.
To what do you attribute that? Why is it so horrifying in America's history, where even places that had terrible racism, as you're saying, South Africa, it did not take that form?
You know, one, I think that the 1619 Project is absolutely correct. Nicole Hannah Jones is absolutely correct that the United States begins, right, with a history of anti-Black racism. So that, you know, Jamestown is founded in 1607. 1619, they begin to import African-American. By the 1640s, you have the beginnings of slave law. Black people become the foundation of this society in terms of the economy. And that deep need, right, the thirst for wealth that's tied to the capitalist nature of the United States, the heightened emphasis on individualism, that all of this comes together in terms of enslavement, in which it's not just the state, but the individual presumes to have ownership over another human being and can do with that human being what they desire. And so we've got 246 years in which white private citizens have absolute control and power over the lives of Black people in a way that is, you know, they rape women habitually, they cut off body parts, all of that. And then when emancipation comes, they've lost the greatest share of wealth. The enslaved population of Black folks, about 4 million, was more valued in dollar terms than all of the factories and railroads in the North. So it's the most valuable commodity. And so that wealth is then taken, and there's deep resentment. And then there's the period of Reconstruction, where there is, for the better part of a decade, a sincere effort to rectify and to try and put Black people in a situation of fairness and in power. And we've got to remember that in the South, when freedom comes, African-Americans are a majority or 50% of three states. They are somewhere between 41 and 49% of four other states, and between 25 and 39% in three other states. So Black folks would have played, if they've been allowed to vote, Black men would have played a significant role in shaping the South. So much of the violence is to prevent Black people from exercising the political clout that their numbers brought them in each Southern state. Much of the violence is tied to the new system that replaces enslavement, what I call the plantation economy, that economy in which sharecropping. And the idea is that there's this notion that cotton is gold, that cotton translates into gold when sold on the world market, and that the key to the revitalization of the U.S. economy and the Southern economy coming out of the Civil War is Black labor. And there's a belief amongst white Southerners and white, the Northern white capitalists as well, that Black people will only work if coerced. And in the process of that coercion and that deep exploitation, you get the creation of the Black codes, you get the creation of all of these anti-Black laws. You ultimately will see the emergence of apartheid, what we in the US call segregation, but it's really apartheid. And to maintain that system of so much oppression, you have to have violence. And because violence is distributed in the United States, it's not just held by the state, it's also held by white private citizens. And so that, I think, goes the best way toward explaining why the U.S. has such a violent racial past and present, actually.
Yeah. I would just add that, as you said, you know, fights over trying to keep Blacks from voting were at the heart of some of these massacres, some of these lynchings and massacres. You know, there was the Colfax massacre in Louisiana in 1873 that involved the contested election for governor there in Louisiana in 1872. More than 62 to 153 people were killed in the Colfax massacre. When that case got to the Supreme Court said, well, you know, states get to decide who votes. When the 14th Amendment said states couldn't take away privileges and immunities of black people, they were only talking about national citizenship, not state citizenship, and you have to have state citizenship to vote. And the other thing, this idea of protecting white women, this was often given as the justification for lynchings. We're protecting white women, and, you know, and this attitude, you know, persists so long. I interviewed Percy Green, who is a sort of a flamboyant civil rights leader in St. Louis, who he climbed up the gateway, the then not yet completed Gateway Arch to dramatize a call for jobs. And that got him into communication with the local big employers, and they would say, we don't want to send electricians or telephone workers, black electricians or telephone workers, into homes for fear of what might happen to the white women there. There's no way that we can hire them to those kinds of jobs. So this same kind of horrible racism that's persisting into the 1960s, 1970s, and of course, even today.
That's right. I really want to second what Bill just said. And I want to emphasize this point that this notion of rape or even attempted rape being the primary cause of lynching is false, but it was the primary justification because it was believed that if you make the argument that Negro men are beasts, and they lust for white women, that could justify this massive sweep of mass murder across the South and indeed throughout the country, that nothing else would justify. Because if you start looking at the numbers and you say, well, okay, this has to do with alleged murder, and then you look at the plantation relationship, landlord, tenant, farmer, and you understand that the tenant is being cheated routinely out of their wages. You understand that those black codes that give the white landlord the right to intervene in the family situation of the tenant, and that they control every aspect of the tenant, give them the right to take children out of the home and put them in apprenticeships. Then you understand that the depth of the oppression could only be maintained through violence. And the state, essentially, the masses of white citizens did not trust the federal or even the state and local governments to deal with black people the way they felt they should be dealt with. And it's not until execution in terms of the electric chair become popular in the 1930s that you begin to see lynchings begin to wane.
Yeah. You know, there's so much more we could talk about with this. We haven't even mentioned sundown towns or relating it to modern history of police violence, to, you know, the more about this. I hope we can come back and continue this conversation another day. I want to thank Professor Sundiata Chajua and Bill Freivogel. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about this today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
More to come after a short break. Do stay with us.